Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador Theodore Katouf, who's the president and CEO of AMIDEAST, which is the American Mideast Educational Training Service, a nonprofit organization that works to strengthen mutual understanding and cooperation between Americans and the people of the Middle East and North Africa. He's a former American diplomat whose 30 years career in public service spans several countries, including Kuwait, Baghdad, Yemen, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Syria. In 1988, he was the director of the Office of Lebanon, Jordan, and Syrian Affairs at the State Department. And from 1992, he served as the Deputy Chief of Mission in Damascus. And from 2000 to 2003, he was the United States Ambassador to Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Theodore Katouf.
Thank you, Ron.
And what's your sense then of this how this deal is proceeding, the Kerry-Lavrov deal? President Assad recently told Fox News that the chemical disarmament would take would cost $1 billion a year and would take a year, and he suggested the U.S. should foot the bill. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, he's actually right when he said it will take a year. I think a lot of experts say it could take even longer. And clearly, somebody's going to have to pay for it, not necessarily all of it the U.S., but there will have to be somebody underwriting the operation, obviously, the U.N., hopefully.
So the Iranian president, the new president, Hassan Rouhani, who's visiting the UN this week, and there's rumors that he may bump into President Obama on Wednesday at the UN. He said that he can help bring peace to Syria. And my understanding is that it was the Iranians who first seized on Secretary of State Kerry's offhand remark at the London press conference, where he said the only way that the Syrians could avoid being bombed by the U.S. was to give up the chemical arsenal, that they behind the scenes told – basically, they apparently have more influence on Assad than anybody. They told him to accept the deal and then allowed the Russians to take credit for it because they recognize that they're kind of kryptonite. They're not particularly popular. Is that your understanding of how things proceeded?
Well, Ian, I think you've described one very prominent report quite correctly. I think we'll be a long time getting at the whole story. I don't think that we know it. I'm skeptical that things happen so quickly that the Iranians could go to the Syrians and then go to the Russians right after an offhand remark by Kerry in London about, as you indicate, about maybe we could avoid a strike on Syria if they would agree to disarm within the next few days. I have to believe that there was something being discussed earlier than that. And I'm not saying that Kerry made that remark deliberately to trigger this. I don't think he did. But at the same time, I don't think there was enough time for all that to fall into place so quickly if something hadn't already been in the works.
But I think as a diplomat, Ambassador Theodore Katouf, what do you know about Iran's new foreign minister, Zarif? Everybody seems to think that he's a pretty accomplished guy and definitely a refreshing change from the Ahmadinejad team.
Well, you know, again, Zarif is seen as a pragmatist and somebody who knows the nuclear file very well, and the fact that Rouhani appointed him would strongly suggest that they're interested in seeing if they can do something to lift sanctions, which are badly harming the Iranian economy, perhaps far worse than we've been led to believe up to now. That could explain why we're seeing all these overtures at the moment, since you have to conclude that the military threat doesn't appear that real to the Iranians. I mean, Obama ran into a lot of difficulties in trying to get public and congressional support for a strike on Syria's chemical weapons, or at least punishing Syria and deterring it from the use of chemical weapons. So if you're sitting in Tehran, you must be saying, he doesn't have much support for initiatives, military initiatives in the Middle East. So it must be the economic pressures that are getting to them.
And you don't think the fact that they lost over 100,000 to chemical weapons in the Iran-Iraq war and towards the end, it was the terror of Scud missiles with chemical weapons landing on Tehran and other cities that apparently drove Ayatollah Khomeini to, as he put it, to drink the poison and seek peace with Iraq?
Well, again, you raise a very good point. The Iranians, I happened to be in Baghdad during 3 years of that Iran-Iraq war. And Saddam was using chemical weapons against massed charges of young Iranians. And it was an effective terror weapon. And it did break several Iranian offensives. And interestingly enough, the Reagan administration tut-tutted quite a bit, but never really took any action against Saddam, at least not for chemical weapons. So, it's a weapon that horrifies Iranians, and there's a revulsion in Iran against the use of those weapons. And I'm sure it's embarrassing for the regime to be seen backing the Assad regime that is using those weapons, even though the Iranians, like the Russians, try to claim that it's the opposition that's stage managing all of this and making Assad look bad.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Theodore Khatouf, who's the president and CEO of AMIDEAST, American Mideast Education and Training Services, a nonprofit organization that works to strengthen mutual understanding and cooperation between Americans and the peoples of the Middle East and North Africa. He's a former American diplomat whose 30-year career in public service spans several countries, including Kuwait, Baghdad, Yemen, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Syria. And in 1988, he was the director of the Office of Lebanon, Jordan, and Syrian Affairs at the State Department. And in 1992, he served as the deputy chief of mission in Damascus. And from 2002 to 2003, he was the United States ambassador to Syria. And Ambassador Khatouf, you're one of the few people that's actually met Maher Assad, the younger brother, who from all accounts is a very violence-prone, a very secretive person. He's in charge of the regime's Praetorian Guard, the Republican Guard, and also oversees the murderous militias. He shot his brother-in-law in the stomach during a family argument over dinner. Is it possible that he was the one who ordered the chemical attack, given that nobody said that it was actually the Assad regime? They hold them responsible, but nobody's actually said who ordered it. And of course, the Russian apology for it and those that swallow the Russian line is that it doesn't make any sense that Assad would do this.
Well, I did meet Maher al-Assad many years ago once over a lunch hosted by a Gulf diplomat, and to me like a mafia wannabe, and I'm only being half facetious. He had the look of somebody who wanted to look tougher than he was, but clearly he is the fellow who sees himself as the protector of the family, the Assad family and the regime. He plays the same role to Bashar as a younger brother of the late Hafez al-Assad, former president of Syria, played for him in those years, which is enforcer and all-around tough guy. So it's very possible Maher had something to do with ordering the strike. It had to almost certainly come from somebody high up the chain of command. But again, what happens in Syria tends to stay in Syria in terms of knowing what's really going on. It's a very secretive regime, and we've never been particularly good at figuring these things out right away.
Well, the UN report, though, indicates the trajectory of these rockets filled with sarin came from the Republican Guard headquarters at the foot of Mount Qasun, which is Maher's headquarters, and on the other side of Mount Qasun, another Republican Guard facility.
Given that, I guess, would there a lot of suspicion point to Maher? Of course. Mm-hmm. Of course, and presumably there is intelligence within the U.S. government that may even pinpoint some of the people who gave and carried out the orders.
But the ironic thing here, Ambassador Theodore Katouf, is that this Kerry Lavrov deal may well save the Assads, at least for another day. There's a possibility that at some point or other, the regime, the military and intelligence people may remove them. I mean, what's your sense? It's a pretty tightly run ship. It's basically a family farm for over 40 years. So, and their Muhabarat, their intelligence service, is supposedly one of the most efficient in the Middle East.
Yeah, you make a good point. I might say it saved two presidencies, because I think our president, his foreign policy credibility was on the line, and he was backed into a corner. So ironically, the president of the United States is able to do a reset, and also Bashar al-Assad has new life. I think he was, perhaps I shouldn't put it quite that way, because I think he was in no danger for the moment of being ousted in any case. But if we do not want those weapons to fall into the hands of the most extreme radicals in the Syrian opposition, these jihadis who are who may not be a majority of the opposition, but they're certainly a very strong and powerful faction within the fighting forces, then we almost need Assad, don't we, stay around to help locate these weapons and ensure that outsiders have access to them to either remove or destroy them in place. So there's a certain, de facto need for Assad, or at least a regime insider, to be in power right now.
And do you think, though, that if something happens this week at the UN, and of course the new Iranian leader had an op-ed in the Washington Post, where he called for an end to blood feuds. Could it be possible that we could have a pivot to Iran? There was the famous pivot to Asia. But in this case, wouldn't it be quite radical in the sense that, first of all, it would seem to me on the surface that the Iranians and the Americans and by extension the Russians have one thing in common. They don't want these Sunni jihadis running Syria, and they don't want Syria to be the Somalia on the Mediterranean. So would it be possible that we could more move towards the Iranian orbit, away from the Saudi-Israeli orbit?
I don't see things going that far, but I think that Iran has influence on a lot of things we care about. Afghanistan, which we're going to be leaving, certainly on the Gulf, our friends, Saudi Arabia and the smaller Gulf states are at dagger points at times with Iran, but they fear Iran as well. Iraq, they have a lot of influence, and of course, Syria and Lebanon. And then there's the nuclear file. So, it seems to me there's only three things that can happen. Either we engage with Iran, it turns out to be productive, and we're able to address a gamut of issues, not just the ones we want to address, which is the nuclear file, but ones they want to address as well in the region. Or two, at some point we're faced with either allowing Iran to have the capability, at least, of building a nuclear weapon on short notice, or three, we have to go to war to prevent it. Given those choices, I would think that the Obama administration is looking very, very closely and with a very interested eye at what might be possible from this opening that the election of Rouhani has given us, and the fact that he seems to some extent to have been empowered by the supreme leader Khamenei, although that's a short leash that can be, and he could be pulled back at any time.
Well, but my understanding is that he has a lot of credibility with the Quds and the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, which he comes out of, and it's a bit like the Nixon going to China syndrome, you know, where he could deliver. But I guess the real issue will be next Friday in Vienna at the IAEA meeting, where Iran, for the 11th time, is going to be asked to open up its nuclear facility. So I guess the proof will be in the pudding next Friday.
Gee, and I feel like I should be interviewing you because you're so well informed on you. You clearly are a great student of these issues and have an impressive amount of knowledge about them. Yeah, you know, the other thing we haven't touched on is the Kerry Lavrov agreement has not been solidified, and that is that the UN Security Council, the United States, and Britain and France want to see a Security Council resolution about Syrian disarmament vis-a-vis chemical weapons with teeth in it, meaning under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter, which would allow for either severe sanctions or even military action if Syria was to renege on this deal or delay it interminably. And the Russians, as usual, are protecting Syria and the Assad regime and saying it's much too soon for all of that. There will be time later. But why are you so suspicious? The Syrians are going to comply, so let's not go there right now.
Right. Well, Ambassador Theodore Khatoub, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Theodore Khatoub, who is the president and CEO of AMIDEAST, which is American Mideast Educational and Training Services, a nonprofit organization that works to strengthen mutual understanding and cooperation between Americans and the people of the Middle East and North Africa. He's a former American diplomat whose 30-year career in public service spans several countries, including Kuwait, Iraq, Yemen, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Syria. And in 1988, he was the director of the Office of Lebanon, Jordan, and Syrian Affairs at the State Department. And in 1992, he served as the Deputy Chief of Mission in Damascus, and from 2002 to 2003, he was the United States Ambassador to Syria. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Sister Simone Campbell.